Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, May the 1st, 2024. I'm Scott Splavik, and here is our first story, and it's entitled Legend of the Fall, Towers Demolished on Iconic Brewery Building. It's written by Maia Bound. The ground shook and red dust billowed from the site of the Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building as a 5,000-pound wrecking ball slammed into the side of the structure. After months of back and forth between Dubuque city officials and building owner Steve Emerson, the demolition of a portion of the expansive building at 3000 Jackson Street has been in full swing this week. Crews on Tuesday morning took down the two towers on the south side of the building and began breaking down the rest of the building beneath the towers. A small crowd watched the demolition from beyond the construction zone fencing, with one neighbor even setting up a chair on the sidewalk. Brandon Zinzer, foreman at demolition contractor D.W. Zinzer Company, said Tuesday morning that the crew's goal was to get the building down to a stable level. As soon as we get it down to a safe level, we're going to reassess the building at that time to see what, if anything, can be saved, Zinzer said. But we're kind of at the mercy of how it falls at this moment. A safe level likely will mean bringing the southern portion of the building down to a single story, Zinzer said. Emerson purchased the roughly 125-year-old Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building in 2017 with plans to convert the structure into residential units and commercial space. His efforts ran into setbacks and delays as the building continued to deteriorate. The building's fate was accelerated in June after a window in one of the towers crashed down into the road, which prompted the closure of a section of 30th Street. Then in August, city officials closed Jackson Street along the western portion of the building after an engineering firm determined the building posed a significant danger to the public. At the city's urging, Emerson then attempted to stabilize the structure, a process that also met delays and in January switched plans to initiate a partial demolition of the building. Demolition began in earnest last week when crews completed asbestos mitigation measures and prepped the site for this week's major demolition work. Zinzer said crews are working quickly to ensure the building is safe so the city can open the surrounding streets as soon as possible. Dubuque Housing and Community Development Director Alexis Steger said once the demolition is complete, crews will work on clearing all the material. D.W. Zinzer Company has done a great job on this, taking it slow, trying to make sure everyone's safe, Steger said. She said Emerson's goal still is to save the northern portion of the building and possibly develop it. Reached by phone Tuesday, Emerson said the day certainly was not something he was looking forward to. I think it was one of the most iconic pieces of architecture in the state of Iowa, and I wanted to save it, but it just couldn't be saved, he said. He said the building's instability prolonged the process to safely remove the asbestos before the structure could come down. Everything took a lot more time because it was a little precarious, he said. It's a really, really tall building in a tight neighborhood. Reaction to the building's demolition was mixed among those who gathered to watch on Tuesday. Bruce McSparren, who lives close to the building, said the road closure and prolonged efforts to stabilize the structure haven't been too bothersome for him personally, though it caused some minor traffic problems. Overall, he said the building has been a relatively quiet neighbor until recently. I always wanted to go through it, but I never got a chance to, he said. Ron Gorman, who lives across the street from the building, said he is not happy to see the structure partially demolished. He believes efforts to save it should have begun decades ago, adding that it is a shame the building was allowed to become so unstable that demolition was the only option. It should have been saved, he said. The city screwed up. Living along the closed road for several months was not the greatest, he said, but he believes the demolition now is needed. Jim McLaughlin grew up close to the building and came to watch it be brought down. He was sad to see the demolition, but acknowledged that it needed to be done. While driving by, Sarah Beckler stopped and joined the small crowd gathered to see the work progress. She said it is sad to see such a historic building come down and that it would have been great to see it renovated like other industrial buildings in Dubuque, such as those in the historic Millwork District. However, she believes the city does a good job of preserving and repurposing what it can, so she is confident that what can be salvaged of the property will be put to good use. My heart just feels for the people who live here, she said. Understandably, if that was my home, I would be a little freaked out all the time if things were falling off. Next is an article entitled Incentives Boosting Effort to Add Housing. Current and planned projects could more than double Dubuque's goal of building 1,100 additional housing units by the year 2030. This is written by Andy Piper of the Telegraph Herald. In 2022, a housing needs assessment for Dubuque painted a bleak picture of available properties for sale or rent. Dubuque City Council set a goal of reversing that trend and expanded several financial incentives to help make that goal a reality. In 2024, those efforts are beginning to take shape. As of March 29th, there were 40 projects either underway or in the city's review process that would bring 2,335 housing units to the city. If they all come to fruition, those units would more than double the city's stated goal of 1,100 additional units by the year 2030. One of the biggest pushes from the planning side of things has really been the housing incentives, said Wally Wuramont, the city's planning services director. Council made a decision to expand our tax increment financing in urban renewal revitalization districts, and by creating those incentives, it has really helped with the costs for development, so we have really seen a big influx of projects coming into our community. Tapping into Iowa Finance Authority low-income housing tax credits has also encouraged development, Wernemont said. The city offers 17 financial incentive programs targeted at builders or buyers. The 2022 assessment conducted by the East Central Intergovernmental Association noted a particular need for workforce housing, defined as housing that is affordable and close to workers' jobs. We actually are seeing our neighboring communities expand to meet our workforce needs for housing, said Alexis Steger, Dubuque Director of Housing and Community Development. Some of our surrounding communities have a little more land, and ours is mostly infill, rededication of land in an urban environment to new construction, which makes some of those bigger developments a little more difficult. We have needs, and our surrounding communities are putting up housing to meet our needs. Steger said the pendulum is slowly swinging back toward Dubuque. Expansion in those neighboring communities is creating workforce housing needs of their own, so she said those developments are not necessarily meeting Dubuque's need. ECIA's review found low vacancy rates for single-family homes and rentals. In 2021, less than 1% of homes were available in those categories, along with about 1.3% of the city's stock of rental units. You also see very low vacancy in the city of Dubuque for rentals, Steger said. That's because our workforce is renting while trying to purchase, and there's nothing out there to purchase. Steger said one ongoing initiative is to create more single-family homes in downtown Dubuque and reduce the number of rentals. She said many single-family homes were converted to rentals over the years, and there is a push to rehabilitate those properties into single-family homes again. The building of all those multifamily structures out west is going to alleviate the need for some of the rentals downtown so they can turn over into home ownership, Steger said. We have to get the units available before we can do that. We are slowly making that transition. The city created six new tax increment finance districts for residential development. Those new districts are at Derby Grange Road, The Point, North Grandview Avenue, South Point in the Rockdale area, North Cascade Road, and English Ridge, located on the city's southwest side near US 20 Southwest Arterial Interchange. I don't think they would build without it, Steger said of the incentives. A big portion of making a development work is the ability to pay less of those taxes right up front while you are trying to fill vacancies. As soon as you get everything built and you are finally full with a couple years of revenue, it makes it easier to pay the full tax. That is really important when it comes to infrastructure, extremely important. A couple of large infill developments are on the drawing board. Union at the Marina, proposed for 1860 Hawthorne Street, the site of the former Riverside Bowl, is under review by the city. It would create 201 affordable housing units. The site of the former Bridge Restaurant is under review for an 81-unit apartment complex. Wernemont said that project came about when the restaurant's owners approached his office and explained they were looking at retirement and wanted to move forward with development of the site. Originally, a plan for duplexes was proposed. Wernemont said the city was more interested in high-density infill development and put the owners in contact with a developer who shared that goal. The 81-unit plan was born. "We're trying to keep more density for walkable neighborhoods," Wernemont said. "When we talk about affordability, lower transportation costs is one of those things when you compare affordability to market rate." Wernemont agreed with Steger that once the proposed projects begin hitting the marketplace, they will create movement up and down the residential housing scale. That movement frees up the market, and a lot of these properties become great for first-time homebuyer properties, Wernemont said, and vice versa. We also will have people housing down as they retire and want to live in a more dense community. Wernemont said his department's review board is swamped with applications, and the city has ample land that can be infilled. "We just haven't moved on it very often," Wernemont said. "We didn't have a lot of residential development going on in the past. We have multiple subdivisions, and now there are more apartments being constructed. A lot of that is a direct result of those incentives." Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald is entitled "Dubuque Family Man Always Very Positive." Even after diagnosis of brain cancer, Andy Doherty kept his focus on those closest to him. This is by Elizabeth Kelsey, and it comes under the A Life Remembered. For Andrew Doherty, family always came first. If the Doherty man's two daughters requested a trip to the park or the pool, Andy was the first one ready. As they got older, he took the girls out for breakfast or donuts on Friday mornings before school. When Andy's own siblings and family members came to town to help him and his wife, Jenny, move into their new house, Andy did much of the work beforehand to give the family more time to relax and be together. And after Andy was diagnosed with brain cancer at age 48, he always took the time to call or FaceTime his daughters while he was out of town for treatments to tell them that he loved them. "As long as his family was around, he was happy," said Jenny. Andy died on March 21st at age 51. He was born November 18, 1972, in Dubuque as the youngest of three children and the only son, born to Larry and Jane Doherty. His sister Tammy Freisinger of Dubuque described Andy as her best friend and said the two were frequently together during their childhoods. "He never met anybody he didn't like, and I'd be hard-pressed to find anybody that didn't like him," she said. "He was easy to love." Andy attended Holy Ghost Elementary School, as did Jenny, though she was a year ahead of him in school. Andy went on to graduate from Wallert Catholic High School, while Jenny attended Hempstead High School. The pair met through Tammy, who worked the same after-school job as Jenny, and introduced them. "He had a little bit of a squirrely sense of humor, and that was much like me," Jenny recalled. "We were just always looking to have fun." Andy's father worked for Hodge in Dubuque for years, and Andy began working there himself as a teenager. After graduating from high school a semester early, Andy took classes at Northeast Iowa Community College and Loras College before leaving to take a full-time job with Hodge, where he would continue working for over 30 years. He ultimately would return to Clark University in his late 20s to complete his college work and graduate with a business degree. Andy and Jenny were married September 9, 1995. They went on to welcome two daughters, Erin, now age 22, and Emma, now age 19. Erin, a self-described daddy's girl, recalled how her father would play video games such as Pac-Man with her almost every evening during her childhood. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he eagerly helped her prepare a series of international dinners from hibachi to homemade tortilla chips, despite his distinct lack of cooking knowledge. "Whatever we wanted to do, everything else would be dropped," Emma said. Andy also instilled in his daughters a love for golf, a sport he played for much of his life. For many years, he could be found each Saturday at Lacoma Golf Club in East Dubuque, Illinois, for a round of golf with Jenny's father. At golf outings, participants clamored for Andy to join their team. Things changed for the family in March of 2021 when Andy began having difficulty remembering simple things such as the street Tammy lived on or the current date. After cognitive tests and an MRI, doctors at University of Iowa hospitals and clinics found a golf ball-sized mass in Andy's brain and diagnosed him with glioblastoma, a fast-growing and aggressive type of brain cancer. At the time, he was told the prognosis was 14 to 18 months with treatment. That's a lot to be told that no matter what, you're going to die, Jenny said. But Andy always was very accepting and very positive. He was determined that he wasn't going to waste his time crying about what was going wrong. He was going to make the best of what he had. After undergoing surgery to remove 95% of the tumor, Andy completed various chemotherapy and radiation treatments in Iowa City. He also wore a device called Optune, which consisted of several electrodes attached to his head that created electrical fields disrupting the cancer cell's growth. Throughout the entire treatment process, Andy was focused on his quality of life, Jenny said. If a particular surgery or treatment would have significantly impaired his quality of life, he did not want to pursue it. He began losing physical strength in May of 2023, which made it difficult for Andy to enjoy things such as golf. That, combined with a seizure in November that left him unable to walk, prompted his family to stop treatment and begin hospice care. I don't think I ever heard him complain or question why he was diagnosed, Aaron said. He just kept reminding me that everybody has something they have to overcome, and this was his. During his final months, the Doughtys ensured that family traditions such as Saturday night meals with Andy's parents could continue by bringing the food to the Doughtys' Dubuque home if Andy couldn't leave. The family also continued a tradition they started when Andy was first diagnosed that involved many family members connecting over video chat every Monday to pray the rosary and converse. Even in the days before his death, Andy continued to thank his wife and daughters for their care and reassure them of his love for them. If he forgot how to say any word, it wasn't, "I love you," Emma said. In the top story on the Dubuque and Tri-State page, officials release cause of death in area homicide. Medical examiner rules Tana Poppy, age 32, died from multiple gunshot wounds. It's written by Grace Neeland of the Telegraph Herald, and the dateline is Lamont, Iowa. State officials have released the cause of death of a woman killed last month in a Dubuque County homicide. Tana Poppy, age 32, was found deceased in a rural Dubuque County home near Lamont on April the 10th. The Iowa Office of the State Medical Examiner completed a forensic autopsy on her body, and the cause of death was ruled as multiple gunshot wounds. Iowa Health and Human Services Department Communications Director Alex Murphy said via email that the death was categorized as a homicide. The Dubuque County Sheriff's Department responded around 7:10 p.m. April the 10th to 9866 Haxby Lane Road, north of Lamont, for a report of an unresponsive individual. Poppy was located deceased inside the home. Further investigation determined that Poppy's two children, a 13-year-old and a 5-month-old, also were living at the residence, but neither were located at the home when authorities arrived. A short time later, authorities learned that a person of interest in the case, Alexander C. Grunke, age 38, of Middleton, Wisconsin, was involved in a vehicle pursuit in Dane County, Wisconsin. The missing 13-year-old also was in the vehicle. The infant had been dropped off unharmed with an acquaintance of Grunke's. Grunke was an ex-boyfriend of Poppy and the father of her 5-month-old baby, court documents state. He was not the father of the 13-year-old, although court documents state the two became close when Grunke and Poppy were dating. During the pursuit, both Grunke and the teen fired weapons at law enforcement authorities state. The vehicle eventually was disabled and the occupants attempted to flee. The 13-year-old was located deceased of unknown causes shortly after authorities said. Grunke fled before entering a residence in Albion, Wisconsin, where he barricaded himself in the basement and later was found deceased from an apparent suicide. Authorities previously stated that law enforcement never fired weapons at Grunke or the teen. Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy said work continues in conjunction with the Dane County Sheriff's Department to investigate the case, but that much of that work has concluded given Grunke's identification as the primary suspect. All of our leads have directed us back to one person, and that person is deceased, said Kennedy in reference to Grunke. There's not a lot of work left to do on this particular case. In response to a records request from the Telegraph Herald, officials from the Dane County Medical Examiner's Office said autopsy results were not yet available for Grunke or the 13-year-old. Next is an article entitled, Clark Grad Pursues Passion for Education as Part of New Program. It's written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. Over the past 2 years, Angie Brown has experienced the world of education through multiple lenses. The Dubuque resident, a paraprofessional at Eisenhower Elementary School, has also been a student since 2022 when she enrolled in Clark University's newly launched Accelerated Elementary Education degree. The program offers people in roles such as paraprofessionals or substitute teachers the chance to earn a teaching degree while continuing to work in classrooms. This Saturday, Brown will graduate with a degree in elementary education and endorsements in reading and special education, one of 14 students in the first cohort of students to graduate from the accelerated program this academic year. I'm just excited about seeing where I end up and the future of the students that I'm going to be working with, she said. Brown, age 42, graduated from the University of Dubuque in 2009 with a bachelor's degree in sociology and held multiple jobs over the years, including assistant manager at a local gas station. In 2018, she began working as a paraprofessional at Eisenhower and developed a love for education thanks to the strong teachers she worked with. They want to see the best in students, and that's what really caught my passion, to want to be a teacher and have an even bigger impact on the students I work with, she said. When I found out about the Accelerated Elementary Education Program, I was all over it. Her coursework was almost entirely online, and Brown was able to complete her practicum work, including student teaching at Eisenhower, where she continued to work as a paraprofessional. Balancing her job with her school and her responsibilities as a parent was challenging at times, but Brown said she received great support from her professors at Clark, Eisenhower staff, and her family. She and her husband, Tim Brown, have two daughters, ages 7 and 13, and Angie Brown also has two older sons, ages 18 and 21. It wasn't always easy, but I'm proud of my accomplishments in getting this far, and I'm proud of the fact that I always gave it my best, she said, adding that she will graduate summa cum laude with a 4.0 grade point average. Brown plans to continue her education and Clark's Master's of Arts in Education program and is currently looking for a teaching position. Lee Johnson, assistant professor of education, supervised Brown's student teaching for her special education endorsement and had her in many classes in the accelerated program. Johnson described Brown as a remarkable student, always eager to learn more. She's a great example of how the program opens opportunities where she can continue to meet her responsibilities to her family, but also her responsibilities to herself in pursuing what she wants to be and what she wants to accomplish, he said. Now some short articles from under the news in brief heading. First, police say gunfire damages house during Dubuque disturbance, 4 arrested. Police said a home was damaged by gunfire during a disturbance Monday in Dubuque and that 4 people were arrested in connection with a related fight. Brittany N. Herber, age 32, of 1852 White Street, was arrested at 8:41 p.m. in the 1800 block of Jackson Street on a charge of unlawful assembly. Dubuque Police Department Lieutenant Luke Bach said 3 juveniles also were arrested on charges of unlawful assembly in connection with the incident. Court documents state that police responded at approximately 6:47 p.m. Monday to the area of 18th and Jackson Streets for a report of a shot being fired. A review of traffic camera footage showed 2 groups of people attempting to fight. There were at least 7 people involved, Bach said. Police met with Herber, who said an unknown subject shot a gun at her, documents state. Bach said gunfire damaged a porch railing at a home in the 1800 block of Jackson Street. Police said Monday's incident marks the 5th case of shots fired with criminal intent in Dubuque this year. The 4th occurred early Sunday in the area of Stafford and High Bluff Streets. The other incidents were on February 12th on Queen Street, March 24th on Romberg Avenue, and April 7th in the area of Gilliam and Mineral Streets, Bach said. Next, authorities say Platteville woman set fire to own home. Authorities said a Southwest Wisconsin woman has been charged with setting her own home ablaze. Jane K. McPhail, age 51, of Platteville, was arrested Saturday on a charge of unsafe burning of one's own building. On Monday, Grant County Circuit Court Judge Craig Day set a $2,500 bond in the case. A report from the Grant County Sheriff's Department states that authorities responded to McPhail's home at 2492 Wisconsin 81 in Platteville Township at about 8:35 p.m. Saturday for a report of a woman who had set her home on fire and was refusing to leave. The woman was identified as McPhail, and she had been extricated from the building by fire officials by the time Grant County Sheriff's Department deputies arrived, the report states. McPhail was taken to Grant County Regional Hospital for medical clearance prior to her arrest, but no further injuries were reported. Grant County Sheriff Nate Dreckman stated the building sustained between $120,000 and $150,000 in damage. Next, local organization donates $12,000 to Dubuque Rescue Mission. A local organization recently donated $12,000 to support a Dubuque nonprofit. The 100-plus Men Who Care Tri-States organization provided the grant to Dubuque Rescue Mission, according to a press release. The release states that the funds will help support the operation of the mission, which provides a public meals program, temporary housing for transients, work opportunities, and other programs to people in need. The 100-plus Men Who Care group meets quarterly and supports local nonprofits. The next meeting is set for 5:30 p.m. Thursday, May the 2nd at Dimensional Brewing Company, 67 Main Street. New members are welcome, according to the release. Now we turn to the opinion page, and we've got an other view written by Elizabeth Hicks, who is an affairs analyst at the Consumer Choice Center. And it's entitled, AI Brings Real Hope for Better Healthcare. How many times have we heard from our leaders that our administration will be the one to finally end cancer? Medical innovation in the United States is profound compared to the rest of the world. Still, clearly, there are many more discoveries to be made. For breast cancer survivors like myself, the intersection of artificial intelligence and healthcare represents not just hope, but tangible progress in the fight against this devastating disease. Reflecting on my journey and those of so many others affected by all types of cancer, I can't help but get excited at the potential of AI to revolutionize diagnostics, pharmaceutical innovation, and direct patient care. Diagnostics is the front line in the battle against cancer, and it holds incredible significance for survivors. According to Harvard's School of Public Health, using AI to make diagnoses may reduce treatment costs by up to 50% and improve health outcomes by 40%. Early interventions tend to cost a lot less. New AI-driven systems are emerging, such as Asimri, which simplifies risk prediction by comparing differences between mammograms and can accurately predict breast cancer 5 years in advance. That's a game changer. Innovation in early detection could spare countless women from unnecessary tests and invasive late-stage procedures, reducing the physical and emotional toll of the diagnostic process. As a survivor who had zero genetic markers and a limited family history of cancer, this breakthrough in early detection is what I needed when my fight with cancer first began. But that's just the start. In addition to earlier detection of breast cancer, AI has shown promise in recognizing skin cancer better than experienced dermatologists. A recent study found that AI detected skin cancer more accurately than 58 international dermatologists after examining more than 100,000 images. The importance of accurate and timely cancer detection cannot be understated. Outsourcing imaging diagnostics to AI could lead to quicker results, lower costs, and better outcomes for patients. In addition to diagnostics, the effect of AI on pharmaceutical innovation is equally exciting. While the advancements in pharmaceuticals over the last few decades have been monumental, AI could further expedite the drug discovery process and bring life-saving treatments to patients faster and cheaper. On average, developing a drug takes more than 10 years and millions of dollars. But AI could stream that process by better predicting how potential drugs might behave in the body. This would effectively eliminate a lot of slow-moving lab work. Clinical trials for fully generative AI pharmaceuticals are already happening. companies started trials last year for a drug called INS-018-055, which aims to treat a chronic lung disease known as idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. The hope is that AI can be applied to create more effective treatment options with fewer adverse side effects at a much quicker pace. AI can easily analyze the entirety of medical records, scans, labs, and other pertinent information to determine quickly which medications or treatments will be most effective. For providers, that means more time spent with patients and less staring at paperwork. Anyone who has worked in an office setting understands the connection between paperwork and staff burnout. AI can help alleviate that burnout. AI developers have taken flack recently from skeptics for their confidence that AI will function like a personal assistant and won't disempower human beings. From 2021 to 2022, more than 71,000 physicians left their clinical jobs, citing overwhelming administrative burdens associated with patient care. That means tasks such as charting during or after patient visits, calling in prescriptions to pharmacies and then being put on hold, determining billing codes, and other tedious, you might say, soul-crushing work. Healthcare professionals are in the people business, and AI can empower them to spend more time with people. There's a lot of reason to be hopeful. With my cancer behind me and my eyes toward the future, I'm really encouraged by what AI could bring to healthcare. And again, this was written by Elizabeth Hicks, who is an affairs analyst at the Consumer Choice Center. Now, a reminder that you are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now it's time to move on to the obituaries. We'll begin with Donnie C. Miller, age 79, of Dubuque, who died Monday, April 29th, at his home in Dubuque. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, May the 2nd, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. The funeral service will be at 10 a.m. on Friday, May the 3rd, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, with Deacon Dave Roth as the celebrant. Burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque at a later date. Full military honors will be rendered by American Legion Post No. 6. The family would like to extend a special thank you to Hospice of Dubuque, Dr. Rahm, Dr. Herman, and Dr. Willenbring for their compassionate care. A photo tribute can be viewed and condolences sent to the family by visiting Donnie's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Next, we remember Paul A. Donovan, age 82, of East Dubuque, Illinois, who passed away on Sunday, April the 28th, at home surrounded by his family. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, May the 2nd, at St. Raphael Cathedral in Dubuque, with Reverend Dennis Quint officiating. Family and friends may call from 3 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday at the Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. Paul's wife and family wish to give thanks to the nurses and staff at 5th Floor Findlay Hospital and Hospice Care of Dubuque for the special care given to Paul and his family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. Next, we remember Rhonda Sue Anderson, age 55, of Dubuque, Iowa, formerly of Platteville, Wisconsin, who died on Friday, April the 26th, from an accident at her home. Rhonda was born June 26, 1968, in Cuba City, Wisconsin. Memorial services celebrating her life will be at 4 p.m. Sunday, May the 5th, at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. Pastor Mary Ann Florgy will celebrate. Burial will be at St. Paul's Catholic Cemetery, Mineral Point, Wisconsin, at a later date. Visitation will be held from 1 p.m. until the time of the service. In honoring Rhonda, the family asks everyone to wear Badger, Packer, or favorite team apparel. Online condolences can be made at www.melbyfh.com. Now we remember Patricia Joan Schmidt, who passed away Sunday, April 28th, 2024, at Acura Healthcare, which had been her residence for the last 4.5 years, where they will miss being serenaded. Her family was by her side to lovingly send her on her way. Friends and family may visit from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, May the 2nd, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, with a wake service at 3:45 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 on Friday, May the 3rd, 2024, at Holy Family Catholic Church in New Melray, with Father Martin Obig officiating. Burial will follow at the church cemetery. In lieu of flowers or memorial gifts, please take the time to visit with the elderly who are alone. Sometimes we don't realize how long and lonely their days are. Thank you to Acura of Cascade for taking such good care of Mom these last years. Now we remember Stuart G. Urban, age 83, of Lancaster, Wisconsin, who passed away on Sunday, April 28th, after a multi-year battle with Alzheimer's disease. A Mass of Christian burial will be held Friday, May the 3rd at 11 a.m. at St. Clement Catholic Church in Lancaster, Wisconsin, with Father Steve Brunner officiating. Family and friends may visit Friday from 9 a.m. until the time of the service at the church. A lunch will follow in the church dining hall. Burial will be at a later date in the Rest Lawn Memorial Park in Wausau, Wisconsin. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster is assisting the family. Online condolences can be left at www.martinschwartzfuneralhomes.com. And Schwartz is S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z. And we remember Alan J. Eveland, age 75, of Platteville, who passed away peacefully on April 29th at home. Alan was born July 30th, 1948, the son of James and Arlen Eveland. A visitation will be held on Saturday, May the 4th, from 2 to 4 p.m., with the celebration of life being held beginning at 4 p.m. Friends are asked to bring their favorite stories and memories of Alan to share. A light meal will follow the celebration. The visitation, celebration of life, and meal will be held at Melby Funeral Home, 1245 North Water Street in Platteville, Wisconsin. Online condolences can be made at www.melbyfh.com. The family would like to thank Dr. White and St. Croix Hospice for their excellent care. Now we remember Jean Rieg, age 81, of Dubuque, who died on Monday, April the 29th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Saturday, May the 4th, at Holy Ghost Catholic Church, where a Mass of Christian burial will follow at 11 a.m. Burial will take place in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 3860 Asbury Road, is assisting the family. Now we remember Jared W. Light, age 46, of Platteville, Wisconsin, who died on Sunday, April the 28th. Visitation will be held from 9 to noon Saturday, May the 4th, at Calvary Community Church in Lancaster, where services will follow. Interment will take place at Liberty Ridge Cemetery in Lancaster. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory of Lancaster is assisting the family. We remember Sue A. Kubage, age 77, of Dubuque, who died on Tuesday, April the 9th. Visitation will be held from 12:30 to 1 p.m. Saturday, May the 4th, at Center Grove Methodist Church, where services will follow. Tri-State Cremation Center of East Dubuque is assisting the family. And we remember James C. Zenz, age 78, of Bloomington, Wisconsin, who died on Thursday, April the 25th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May 11th, at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster, where services will follow. Burial will take place at a later date. And we remember Elizabeth A. Short, age 81, of Cassville, Wisconsin, who died on Saturday, April the 27th, 2024. Services will be held at a later date. Hodden Shield Funeral Home and Crematory of Cuba City is assisting the family. We'll read a couple more local stories before we move on to the sports. First, unemployment rates drop in local Iowa counties, rise slightly in Wisconsin. Unemployment rates dropped in local Iowa counties while rising slightly in Wisconsin compared to a year earlier, according to recently released reports. Dubuque County's unemployment rate was 2.9% in March, down from the 3.4% recorded in February and down from the 3.2% recorded in March 2023, according to Iowa Workforce Development. Elsewhere in the state, Clayton County's unemployment rate was 4.1% in March, compared to 5.6% in February and 5.3% in March of 2023. Delaware County's rate was 2.7%, down from 3.3% in February and down from 3.1% a year earlier. Jackson County's rate was 3.5%, down from 4.6% in February and down from 4.3% a year earlier. Iowa's statewide unemployment rate was 2.9% in March, down from 3% in February, but up from 2.8% a year ago. In Wisconsin, Lafayette County's unemployment rate was 2.6% in March, according to Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development. The county's unemployment rate was 2.5% in March of 2023. Crawford County's unemployment rate was 4.7% in March, up from 4.6% in March 2023. Grant County's rate was 3.2%, up slightly from 3.1% a year ago, and Iowa County's rate was 3.1%, up from 2.9% a year ago. Statewide, Wisconsin's unemployment rate was 3% in March, up from 2.6% a year ago. In Illinois, Joe Davies County's unemployment rate was 5.6% in March, up from 5.1% a year earlier, according to the Illinois Department of Employment Security. Statewide, Illinois' unemployment rate was 5% in March, up from 4.3% a year earlier. Ernst staff to hold office hours in local counties in May. Staff of U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, will hold mobile office hours in Clayton, Delaware, Dubuque, and Jackson counties in the coming weeks. Ernst's staff will be available to help Iowans with issues involving Social Security, veterans benefits, military affairs, passports, immigration issues, and other federal programs, according to a press release. Constituents unable to attend the traveling office hours but who still seek help with federal agencies can contact one of the senator's offices or submit a casework request at ernst.state.gov. Upcoming office hours are Clayton County, 2 to 3 p.m. Tuesday, May the 7th, Elkader Public Library, 1030 North Main Street, Dubuque County, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Thursday, May the 9th, James Kennedy Public Library, 320 First Avenue East in Dyersville. Delaware County from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. Thursday, May the 9th, Delaware County Community Center, 200 East Acres Street in Manchester. And Jackson County from 2 to 3 p.m. May 16th, Maquoketa Public Library, 126 South 2nd Street. Next, theft case dismissed against Dubuque man. A theft case against a Dubuque man has been dismissed. Louis G. Mihalikas, age 60, previously was charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with second-degree theft and conspiracy to commit a non-forcible felony. Iowa District Court Judge Michael Schubert recently approved prosecutor's motion to dismiss the case. Assistant County Attorney Sharon Halstus wrote in the motion that further investigation is needed. Court documents alleged Mihalikas was one of four people to engage in a retail theft scheme in Dubuque alongside area residents Adam C. Spinoso, age 30, Andrew Trilk, age 34, and Sapphire Lanhart, age 27. Documents state the group processed no receipt returns at Menards, 5300 West Side Drive, last year for items the store identified as having been stolen. Documents state that the group stole items from Menards locations in Dubuque and Platteville, Wisconsin, then processed no receipt returns on the stolen merchandise to obtain $3,277 in store credit, of which $2,085 was redeemed. Spinoso, Trilk, and Lanhart all previously were sentenced to probation for their roles in the scheme. Now it's time to turn to sports, and here's what's on television today. In Major League Baseball, we've got the Cardinals at the Tigers at 12 p.m. on the Bally Sports Midwest channel. The Rays are at the Brewers at 12:10 p.m. on the Bally Sports Wisconsin channel. And the Twins are at the White Sox at 1:10 p.m. on the NBC Sports channel. And the Cubs are at the Mets at 6:10 p.m. on Marquee Sports Network. College baseball, Mississippi State at Ole Miss, 6 p.m. on ESPNU. Hockey, Golden Knights at the Stars at 6:30 p.m. on ESPN, and the Kings at the Oilers at 9 p.m. on ESPN. NBA basketball, Heat at Celtics, 6:30 p.m. on TNT, and Mavericks at Clippers at 9 p.m. on TNT. In girls high school golf, Bobcats claim county meet championship. This is written by Steve Stoles. Two teams with legitimate expectations to be in contention for state titles in their respective classes can't even be sure which one is the best team in Dubuque County this spring. On a rare, mild, and calm weather day, the Western Dubuque girls golf team bested Dubuque Wallert for first place in the Dubuque County meet Tuesday afternoon at the Dubuque Golf and Country Club. After edging Wallert for second place at Monday's MVC Super Meet in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the Bobcats dominated the four-team county field, defeating Wallert by an impressive 19 strokes, 300 to 319. Dubuque Senior was third at 366, and Dubuque Hempstead finished fourth at a distant 398. Western Dubuque coach Brooke Lucan was not surprised by her team's performance after a strong second-place finish Monday. "The girls have a positive attitude and believe in themselves," said Lucan. "I think they learned that today, shooting a 300, that no one can stop them if they have that mindset. This is a true testament to the time and work they put in. If we keep building off of this, I think we'll have a lot of fun this postseason." With the win, Western Dubuque has now won four meets this spring to go along with three second-place finishes. Wallert also has four first-place wins and one second-place finish. Leading the Bobcats' victory was decorated senior McKenna Stackis, who shot a stunning 2-under-68, six shots better than runners-up Ava Kalb and Aylin Mueller from Wallert, who carded 74s. Western Dubuque's top four all shot below 80, with Addie Jones shooting 76, Cece Ball 77, and Amber Wilson 79. Stackis, who also was a medalist a week ago at the Bobcat Invitational, including all the city teams, was greatly relieved after struggling at the Super Meet. "It feels good to have a 68, she said. "Yesterday wasn't a great day for me with an 81 in Cedar Rapids. To come out today and shoot 2-under is a huge boost and confidence builder. Today everything was great. I was hitting my putts, hitting fairways and greens, and the weather was amazing." Regarding the rivalry this season with Wallert, Lucan thought the competition helped both teams. "Wallert has a great team," Lucan said. "The girls know each other, they are competitive with each other, and I think that helps both teams succeed. I think they build off each other." The Golden Eagles could not keep pace with Western Dubuque after the 74s by Kalb and Mueller. Julia Bush finished at 85, and Kate Earing shot 86. Dubuque Senior was paced by Ava Finnan with an 87, Dempsey White with an 89, Jordan Westhoff at 94, and Addie Safran at 96. Hempstead's Brooke Kelsch was the only Mustang to break 100 with an 87. Danielle McQuillan, Lauren Haverland, and Ellie Hermiston were next for Hempstead. Wallert coach Dan Mulligan knew his team ran into a buzzsaw with Western Dubuque. "They got us today, so they get the honor," Mulligan said. "On a given day, we both have very strong teams. Both teams put in a lot of hard work and are reaping the benefits this season. Both of us are top teams in our 4A and 3A class, and I think both teams are looking forward to the rest of the season." And in high school softball, Pirates time it right. Hahn throws gem, Zmich hits late homer to lift Galena. It's written by Tim O'Neill. Dateline is East Dubuque. For five innings, it appeared like Galena ace Ava Hahn was going to have a stellar outing overshadowed by her counterpart. One swing changed everything. Hahn took a no-hitter into the fifth inning and struck out 14, and Addie's Mitch hit a go-ahead three-run home run with two outs in the sixth as Galena rallied past East Dubuque on Tuesday in a game that featured a pitching masterclass. I think we were all nervous, but we had to lock in and get ready. But it was rocky there in the beginnings, Mitch said. That holds true for both teams. Hahn, who recorded her 500th career strikeout in Monday's win over Potosi-Cassville, threw 76 of her 117 pitches for strikes. She allowed 3 hits, walked 2, and hit a batter. It was her 6th consecutive game with a double-digit strikeouts. She fanned 86 over that stretch. She seems like she gets stronger the more innings she pitches, Galena coach Jerry Westmeyer said. Ava is a different person when it comes out on the mound. She just focuses, and she has a changeup that is unbelievable. When that is working, everything else is working. But for a while, it looked like the East Dubuque was going to squeak out a win behind ace Curran Oberman, who took a tough luck loss after striking out 13 and allowing just 4 hits. After allowing a single on the first pitch of the game, Oberman struck out the next 8 batters on just 29 pitches. She walked 1 and threw 58 of her 77 pitches for strikes. The Warriors played small ball to take a 2-0 lead. Isabel Stewart was hit by a pitch leading off the bottom of the first, stole second, advanced to third on a passed ball, and scored on an error. Elise Anglice led off the fifth with a walk and came around to score on a wild pitch and a pair of passed balls. You just had to forget about it. I knew my team had my back, Hahn said. We just had to trust our mechanics and get our bats going, and I knew that would happen. Meanwhile, the Pirates were having challenges of their own with Oberman. After the leadoff single to Avery Werner in the first, Oberman retired the next 16 batters she faced. But Josie Frank, inserted into the lineup the previous inning after starting catcher Ella Dodds, took a foul ball off her hand, worked a one-out walk to start the Pirates' rally in the sixth. Frank moved to second on a ground out before Hahn lined an infield single off the glove of first baseman Hannah Heitkamp. Zmitch unloaded on the next pitch, blasting a high-arcing fly ball that just cleared the fence in right for a 3-2 lead. It was perfect timing for her first home run of the season after hitting 6 last spring. I was like, when is it going to come? And then it finally came, Zmitch said. The timing couldn't have been worse for the Warriors, though. It comes down to one pitch. That's just the game of softball, Edler said. She misses by an inch, and she was perfect every other pitch. But Oberman is a phenomenal player. She's a freshman, too, so she's kind of down on herself because she's a competitor, but she'll be ready to go on Thursday. Liliana Alvarado smacked a 2-out double in the 7th, but was stranded there when Hahn induced a pop-out back to the circle from Stewart to end the game. The teams meet again Thursday in Galena and will be motivated by more than just bragging rights. Both teams are in contention for the Northwest Upstate Illini Conference Championship, but both need to win their remaining games and hope Fulton, loses at least once. In high school tennis, Mustangs blank Rams. Hempstead's Claire Kelly improves to 13-0 in singles matches this year. It's written by Danny Miller of the Telegraph Herald. Claire Kelly continued her run of perfection on Tuesday. She noted a stringent off-season training program as one of the contributing factors, but gave most of the credit to her teammates and coaches. Just this amazing team, Kelly said after improving her singles record to 13-0 with a 6-2, 6-1 victory over Dubuque seniors Liz Nielsen at Myers Courts. I just have all the support I need to have this kind of season and great coaches, too. They will really help me in practice and make me focus on what I need to do. Kelly's win helped Hempstead secure the match early as the Mustangs swept the Rams 6-0 in singles play. Hempstead won the match 7-0 after Lightning ended the doubles play early. We're all so equal as players, so we really do work together, Kelly said. We definitely do have a strong lineup all the way through, so that really helps us, just having fun and supporting each other. Maddie Brosnahan beat seniors Lacey King 6-1, 6-1 in the number one singles match, while Lean Cassis bested Madison Arrington 6-4, 6-3 at number two. In the number three match, seniors Halea Christensen won her opening set 6-1 before the Mustangs' Noor Cassis rallied to win the second 6-2 and steal the victory in a third set tiebreaker. Hempstead also got wins from Maya Hoden over Charlotte Mozina and Jordan Hancock over Lauren Nemers. Noor Cassis and Addie Scardino topped Mozina and Nemers before Lightning wiped out the remaining two doubles contests, giving the Mustangs a 7-0 victory. I'm just really excited about the effort these girls have given all season, Hempstead coach Sarah Lester said. I think they've really picked up the mentality that they want to give 100% all the time, and they're figuring out when they do that and don't give up, things are happening. The Mustangs improved their record to 9-4 overall. Three of those losses have come by a slim 5-4 decision, and all but one has come to teams ranked inside the top 10, including Saturday's one-point defeat at Class 1A top-ranked Cedar Rapids Xavier. We've lost some really close ones. They've outproduced what I really thought we could do this year, and they're not done yet, Lester said. They're having fun, too, and because they're having fun, they're working hard. The Rams dropped an 8-1 decision in a rescheduled match earlier the Tuesday, but notched their first two wins of the season with a sweep of Cedar Rapids Jefferson and Cedar Rapids Kennedy last Saturday. They've come a long way from the beginning of the year, senior coach Chris Miller said. I think if we replayed a lot of those games from earlier in the season, we'd see some different results. I'm proud of them for pushing through those losses and coming back and getting those two last weekend. Hempstead and Senior close their regular season slates on Thursday. The Mustangs host Wallert while Senior visits Western Dubuque. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.